is Netta Engelhardt from MIT, and she's an assistant professor there. She got her PhD from UCSB in Santa Barbara, and she has been associated with research at Princeton before joining MIT in 2019. And she works on gravitational aspects of string theory, so correlated to the talk we just heard. So Netta, please start. And Netta prefers to have questions along the way with her talk. So if you have a question, put it on the chat, and then we will try to take it as we go along.
But I reserve the right to change my mind in the middle of the talk if it gets out of hand.
Okay.
Let me just share my screen. Great, okay. Thank you very much for the introduction, and thank you to all the organizers for putting together this conference and persevering despite the current situation. It's been really interesting, and it's been fun to see everyone here. So this, I titled this talk Free Energy from Replica Wormholes, and I sort of regretted that as soon as I sent in the email with the title, because this is a somewhat technical sounding title. And so to make up for that, I'm actually going to spend the first half or so of the talk setting up motivation and explaining the background of why we care about these replica wormholes and why we want to calculate the free energy, including these so-called replica wormholes. So the first half or so of this talk is going to be a lot of backgrounds, just setting up the recent developments on this black hole information paradox front in this specific way. So with no further ado, let me begin. So, sorry, these computers, just one second. Okay. So here I've drawn an evaporating black hole, sort of the symbol of the information paradox. And of course, the information paradox is one way in which we are trying to get a handle on quantum gravity. It has the potential to give us a lot of insight. And the past year has seen a bit of a renaissance in terms of the black hole information paradox, at least as far as the ADS-CFT correspondence goes, and in some cases even and some of these insights are starting to go beyond that. So insights from these developments have started to teach us more, I would say, about gravity in general in certain cases. So in particular, these replica wormholes. So what are they? What are they doing here? What do I mean by that? The broad goal of these recent developments, what they've been doing and what they've been working towards or have done is a computation of the evolution of entropy, which looks unitary. And this is done by a replica trick, or this can be derived by a replica trick, which I will review later in the talk. And it turns out that the inclusion of replica wormholes, which are Euclidean wormholes that go into this replica calculation, can really shed new light on some of the old insights that have been around for a while about Euclidean wormholes and ensembles and gravity and the gravitational path integral. So what I'm going to do is I'll set the stage first. I'm going to review some of these developments, and I'll talk about the context and where they started, where they are right now. And then I'm going to discuss some of this new work on replica wormholes that came out in the archive last night with Sebastian Fischetti and Alex Maloney. So this is the structure of this talk. I'll begin with just again this review of the black hole information paradox. Then I'll talk about the replica trick for the free energy. For those members of the audience who are familiar with the replica trick for the von Neumann entropy, this is a different type of replica trick. Then I'll talk about the free energy in JT gravity. This is the main calculation that we did in this paper that came out last night. And I'll close with some summary and comments. So, new developments. All right, what are these new developments that I'm talking about? This is started a little over a year ago. Now with two papers that initially were centered around one goal, which is to derive the page curve for an evaporating black hole. The truth of the matter is the goal was a little more complicated. It involved trying to understand the holographic description of the Hayden-Prescott protocol. But for now, I'm going to say that the goal was really just to derive the page curve for an evaporating black hole. So here I've drawn several different behaviors of entropy as a function of time for an evaporating black hole. So we have the black hole entropy, which is just the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. And since an evaporating when black hole shrinks in area, this entropy is decreasing. We have the entropy of the radiation as computed by Hawking, which according to his calculation increases and eventually saturates. And then we have Page's result, which says that a unitary evolution would have to, in the entropy of the radiation, would have to have a turnover and look like this blue curve over here. So this one, this would be the unitary evolution. Now, computing this unitary evolution, is computing a Page curve with unitary evolution is very, it's a big goal in quantum gravity. It's been a goal for several decades, just for those of us who subscribe to unitarity in quantum gravity. So so what's new? Why did we suddenly believe that we could do this calculation when we could not do it in the past? And the answer is that there were two new ingredients here that have not been available for that long. The first one, we're not going to use Hawking's formula for computing the entropy. If you use it, then, well, you get information loss. We instead are going to use a holographic formula for the entropy. So in ADS-CFT, you could calculate the entropy just using Hawking's results, or you could calculate it using the holographic prescription. So we have a different way of calculating the entropy. And the second is forcing a large ADS black hole to evaporate so we can use the ADS-CFT correspondence to do this calculation. So first, let's begin with the entropy formula. What entropy formula did we use? Well, instead of using minus trace rho log rho, we're going to use this formula, which has appeared already in multiple talks. It's a minimum over surfaces that extremize this quantity, which is called the generalized entropy. It was first proposed by Jacob Bekenstein for a somewhat different purpose. So here, this I'm going to give a slightly more detailed description on the next slide. This is the area of a surface over 4G H bar plus the Vonnegut entropy on one side of it. So let me be a little bit more explicit. This is the so-called quantum extremal surface prescription. So the Vonnegut entropy of some state rho sub r. So we might imagine in more than three bulk dimensions, we can take a boundary subregion r. And this is reduced density matrix on that. And the von Neumann entropy of that is going to be computed by the sum of these two terms, which is again called the generalized entropy, where the surface curly X is the minimal generalized entropy surface that extremizes the generalized entropy. In other words, you take all of the surfaces that extremize the generalized entropy subject to the constraint that they're homologous to this region R. And then you take the one, if you have multiple such surfaces, you take the minimal one, the one that minimizes this generalized entropy. And so here I've drawn this candidate extremal surface and the von Neumann entropy is evaluated on one side. Now I'm just going to say a couple of words about the entanglement wedge. This has already been discussed a little bit in other talks, but it is somewhat important for the motivation here. So here I've drawn just a Lorentzian picture that's 3D, the time added in the slide before. The slide before here was just a single time slice. So in a Lorentzian picture here, the region between XR, the quantum extremal surface, and this region R, the always causal diamond, this is known as the entanglement wedge. You could think of this as the region which is space-like separated to XR and between XR and the boundary. And the reason that I mentioned this entanglement wedge is because it's part of one of the most useful, at least very, very useful aspects of the dictionary, of the ADS-CFT dictionary, which is subregion duality. It just taught us a lot about the nature of ADS-CFT, which is the statement that the entanglement wedge, this region between X, R, and R, is dual to R. Now, the way I say it sounds very fluffy. I'm not really going to get into too much of the detail. Really what we mean is that the physics in one is encoded in the other. At the end of the day, this is the precise statement to be made here in terms of operator algebras, but I won't need it for this talk, so I would prefer not to go into that. Okay, so now we have our entropy formula, and we'd like to evaporate our ADS black hole. And now, large ADS black holes don't typically evaporate, but we can force one to evaporate by coupling it to an external reservoir at a lower temperature. So this is a picture here where we have some bath, which is at a lower temperature, and at some point we put transparent boundary conditions between the bath and the bulk. And then they allow for this free exchange via transparent boundary conditions. And because the bath is a lower temperature, the black hole in the bulk evaporates into it. So I'm not going to go into too many of the details here because the technical details are not very important for the overall motivation for why we're interested in replica wormholes. But let me just say a few words about qualitatively what happens and the qualitative setup. So to do the calculations explicitly, we work in two-dimensional JT gravity. And what we do to evaporate the black hole is we consider a BCFT. This lives in flat space with no gravity. And it's BCFT, so it means that it lives in half of Minkowski space here. What we do is it's ADS2, so it's a two side, it has two boundaries. And we couple these two systems via a quantum quench. Now, this results in a shockwave going into the bulk, after which the black hole evaporates into this external reservoir. So now we have an evaporating ADS black hole. We have a formula for the entropy that we can use. An evaporating ADS black hole, we have a formula for the entropy. So we're ready to calculate something like a Page curve. Now, again, I'm not going to go into too many of the details here, but I do want to qualitatively discuss what happens. So before we evaporate the black hole, we just have this two-sided black hole, the left side and the right side. The entanglement wedge of the right side is this wedge right here. The entanglement wedge of the left side is the wedge right here. And the quantum extremal surface for the left is this X sub L. The quantum extremal surface for the right is X sub R. So in this picture here, before we start evaporating the black hole, the quantum extremal surface for the left is also the quantum extremal surface for the right. They coincide. Now, as we evaporate the black hole, initially the surface X sub R moves continuously in a space-like direction. But at late times, a new branch of quantum extremal surfaces that have no classical counterpart, they're not anywhere near a classical extremal surface, begins to dominate. And by dominate, I mean it has a smaller generalized entropy than the one that we would have gotten by continuously deforming from the classical extremal surface. Now, again, this was discussed in some detail in some of the other talks, so I won't spend too long on it. But the key point here is that after the transition, this right quantum extremal surface is far from the left quantum extremal surface. And furthermore, this transition, this switch in dominance between quantum extremal surfaces, that is what results in the unitary Page curve in the book. It is critical for getting this unitary behavior for the late time behavior in the unitary Page curve. Now, let's make an interesting observation right now. If we take the radiation, which we've gathered in this auxiliary reservoir, and we throw it into the left side, then this left quantum extremal surface will shift and will shift over to the right. And this suggests that the region in between these two, between the left and the right quantum extremal surfaces, may be, in some sense, encoded in the Hawking radiation, which is precisely what was hypothesized in these papers. That this region between XL and XR, which is shaded in gray here, is in a sense that I won't make precise here, the entanglement wedge of the radiation. Now, this is what has led Hiren Mahajan, Maldusena, and Zhou to suggest this quantum extremal island formula. So this can be thought of as a generalization of the quantum extremal surface formula. So here, the main difference is that we're considering this entropy over here, this is not exactly a generalized entropy. We have this additional contribution from this set R. And what we're computing is the von Neumann entropy of the radiation, which is given by, so here I is a Cauchy slice of this gray region, and we are considering its boundary here. So this can be taken to be essentially a statement that the entanglement wedge, that this gray region is the entanglement wedge of the radiation, or is encoded in the radiation. Now, let me go back a slide. Now, this is a hypothesis. It's a conjecture. And we would like to, this, it seems like a very deep conjecture. It's a statement about the Hawking radiation. And we would like to understand better where this comes from and how to derive it. And so this has led to two groups. We call them the East Coast group and the West Coast group, or East Coast model and the West Coast model, because reputationally, geographically, where they're located. And these were toy models in which this quantum extremal island formula can actually be derived. So I'm going to primarily be using intuition from the East Coast model, but let me just briefly mention what both of them are. So in the East Coast model, this left part of the diagram here, we have it's ADS2, and you have the asymptotic boundary, and you have just no gravity region out here on both sides. So this is always coupled, and you always have transparent boundary conditions here at the ADS boundary. The West Coast model is it's essentially doing something similar, but it's modeling it rather differently. Here you have instead an end of the world brain. Again, this is GT gravity, but with an end of the world brain. You have a single asymptotic boundary here. I won't have much to say about the West Coast model. This is mainly meant to be here for completeness. And I'll just use the East Coast model more as a motivational picture. So here we have two models where actually they were able to derive this island formula. And this is where the replica wormholes come in. So let's take a look at what the island formula would look like here. So you want to compute the entropy of some part of the radiation R. And this is going to involve some island in the bulk. So this is the region over here. This is in the non-gravitational part of the space-time, and this is in the gravitational part of the space-time. So how does one do this? Well, in general, we have there's a nice way of computing von Neumann entropies, which is called the replica trick. So let's forget about gravity for a moment and just review the replica trick for computing the von Neumann entropy. The nth Rennie entropy of some rho r is defined in this way, and the von Neumann entropy is computed by taking the n goes to 1 limit. Now, I'm going to now switch to Euclidean signature, simply because everything else I'll say will be in Euclidean signature. It's simpler. Some things have been generalized to Lorentzian signature, some things have not, but probably can be or will be in the future. Now, if we're switching to Euclidean signature, we can rewrite the state in terms of the Euclidean partition function and get the following formula for the von Neumann entropy. So this is the replica trick now. Now, what do these different symbols represent? Well, this is just the partition function on B, and this B here is just the spacetime, and Z of B sub n is the partition function on B sub n, which is an n-sheeted geometry consisting of n copies of B, which are cut along R. Remember, this is their density matrix on R, and cyclically identified along R. So here is a figure. So we have these n copies, and here is the cut R, and these are all cyclically identified along R. So this is the von Neumann entropy replica trick. And so far, I haven't said anything about gravity, but now I will. So let's get back to gravity. What is the idea? Well, again, we're going to stick to the Euclidean case, even though this has actually been generalized. This is the idea is that you replace z by the gravitational path integral. So instead of z of b, you take the gravitational path integral, which I'll denote p of b, which is given by the gravitational path integral with boundary conditions b. And z of b sub n is the gravitational path integral on b sub n, this multi-sheeted geometry. Now, in the East Coast model, just as an example, the identified region R is actually not in the gravitational region. So the gravitational path integral is over n copies of the ADS boundary. So you don't have an identification within the gravitational region. So here is what it would look like. You have this, all of these copies, and this is the boundary conditions on the gravitational Euclidean path integral. So the gravitational path integral P of B to the n, again, n copies of the asymptotic of the ADS boundary B. Now, in general, we can write it like this. We have the contribution here from P of B raised to the power n. So these are all disconnected topologies, plus whatever contributions we get from connected topologies, for example, something like this. Now, there's been a lot of discussion over the years about whether connected topologies should or should not be included in the gravitational path integral. Now, without taking a stand on it just yet, it was found by both the East Coast and West Coast groups that after the page time, the contribution from connected topologies, in other words, things that look like this, or connect more than connect n boundaries. This dominates. Now, should these topologies be included? Well, sometimes we justify things by saying, well, we'd like to include it because it gives us an answer that we really like. So these topologies are precisely what gives rise to the quantum extrema island formula. And we would like to include them because they give us a unitary answer, and we subscribe to a unitary quantum theory of gravity. Now, including them does tell us that the path integral of on over n boundaries is not the same as the path integral on one boundary raised to the power n. And if we take the, if we say, imagine that the path integral is exactly equal to the partition function, then we find something that's very odd. That the partition function of B of dm is not the partition function of B raised to the power n. Now, one possibility that has long been discussed in the literature is that the gravitational path integral computes an ensemble average. And in that case, that this the fact that the gravitational path integral on n boundaries is not the same as the gravitational path integral raised to the power n is does not actually imply this statement here, because it would be talking about an ensemble average. Now, just as an aside, what we mean by an ensemble or disorder averaging in general, what we normally mean is that we have some partition function z sub g of b, which is defined with respect to some choice of coupling constants g, that are sampled from a distribution called P of G. And the ensemble average is this integral against the distribution. Now, if, and I'm not saying this is it, I'm not subscribing to any particular interpretation, but if this is what the gravitational path integral is computing, in other words, if this is what's happening in semi-classical gravity, it's really not obvious what an individual ZG of B is. Now, for what I'm going to say about the free energy and replica wormholes, I'll be mostly agnostic about whether the gravitational path integral is ensemble averaging or not, and really focus more on whether connected topologies contribute or not, whether we are forced to conclude that they contribute. But so I'll be somewhat agnostic about the interpretation of this. Now, a few lessons at this point. So if we want to take this replica wormhole seriously, and again, we do because they give us the island formula, because they give us unitarity, they give us a unitary page curve, then we really need to understand better what kind of calculation the path integral is doing. What is this, what are the, if it is actually doing an ensemble average, what is it averaging over? What are these individuals z sub g of b? And very important, in my opinion, are what are the implications on other observables, the implications of the inclusion of replica wormholes, potentially of this averaging, if it is in fact doing an averaging. And so the question of whether we can see signatures of replica wormholes beyond the Rennie entropies is very important, in part because the Rennie entropies are not the most fine-grained observable we can look at for any system. It gives us some information, but there's a lot more out there. As an example, we might ask about the generating functional, log z, or the free energy, minus t log z. This is something that is in some sense more primitive, but contains information that is different. And so this leads me to the first section, which is not a review of the black hole information paradox, which is the replica trick for the free energy. So if the gravitational path integral receives contributions from connected topologies, in principle, it's possible that there's a big difference between the log of z, where the bar here denotes an ensemble average, or if you don't like the ensemble average interpretation, the bar denotes whatever the path integral is computing, versus the average over all of a log of z, like when the average is taken over all of it, where we computed the way that the path integral would compute the partition function. So this first thing here is what we call the annealed free energy, or in this case, generating functional. This would compute an average over random variables that define a particular instance of the ensemble if we're subscribing to the ensemble averaging interpretation. And this suggests that potentially there's an interpretation here as a partition function of a theory in which the random variables are allowed to equilibrate. Now, this doesn't really sound like what we're looking for, The second one is a quench, what we call a quenched average, which computes an average over free energies. So here we're computing an average over free energies, which means that the random variables are not allowed to equilibrate.
So Neta, we have a question actually. So you want to take it now?
Sure, I'll try to take it now. If it ends up being too long, then I'll defer it to the Q&A.
Yeah, so Lauren, you want to ask Neta?
Can you hear me? Yeah, okay. Yeah, no, I'm okay if it's later. It's just that and maybe you can postpone the answer. I'm confused about the conceptual point about the logic. That is, the goal, what I understood is that the goal is to restore unitarity. And then you say that you can do that in a context where suddenly you have an ensemble average. I understand that every element of that average is a unitary theory, but still an ensemble average is a non-unitary description of the system. So somehow you restore unitarity by breaking it, and so I'm kind of confused about the conceptual logic like here. Do you see my point?
So it's important that every member of the ensemble is evolving unitarily. I would not call an ensemble average breaking unitarity, but I also want to be quite clear that including replica wormholes doesn't prove that you have an ensemble average. There are other ways of accounting for why you have replica wormholes in the theory that do not necessarily involve an ensemble average. I'm using the ensemble average here as one potential interpretation of this, but not necessarily the only one.
Okay, maybe we can have a deeper discussion that if you have an ensemble average, there is a breaking of unitarity, but maybe we could, you know, by definition, but maybe we could discuss that later.
Maybe let's save that for later, in the Q&A or on the Slack.
So just to remind you, Neta, you have about 10 minutes left, so.
Oh, okay, so I better get a move on, all right. Okay, so what we would like to compute really is the quenched free energy, because this is what computes the average over the free energies, that the one where the random variables are not allowed to equilibrate. Now, the problem is if the path integral of P of B to the N is not, if it doesn't commute, with, so here, as I've written, the Z of B to the N is not equal to Z of B raised to the power N, then we might expect that the similar thing happens with the quenched and annealed disorder, or the quenched and annealed free energies. So we want to compute this averaged log Z, but it's really not clear how we're going to calculate that from the gravitational path integral. So the way to do this is actually via a replica trick, which might be older than the von Neumann entropy replica trick, I'm not sure. At least the condensed matter theorists have been doing this for decades. So if you forget about gravity for a second here, we can just write log of Z of B as just a replica trick here, where we introduce M replicas and we don't couple them in any way. I'll have a figure in a couple slides. And we take this limit as analytic continuation as M goes to zero. This is different from the von Neumann entropy replica trick. And this we can calculate from the gravitational path integral because we know how to make sense of this object in terms of the gravitational path integral. That just becomes, if we average, this PB to the M. So if replica wormholes can contribute non-trivially in this M goes to zero limit to the log Z replica trick, then this annealed free, this quenched free energy is very different from the annealed free energy, the one that computes log of P of B, which would correspond to only including disconnected topologies. So this is what contributes to the annealed free energy, log P of B, only disconnected topology. And the quenched one, which is computed using this replica trick, can in principle include connected topologies, so replica wormholes. Now, let's do an example here. We've already seen one replica trick. Let's see both of them at play together. We can compute, if you want to compute the von Neumann entropy correctly using the gravitational path integral, we actually need to do two compounded replica tricks. So here is this the overbar, which denotes a computation from the gravitational path integral. And this is the first formula that we're familiar with that we saw before. But for each one of these logs, we have to replace it with another replica trick. And so what we get is these N replicas that come from the von Neumann entropy replica trick. These are identified along this cut. And then in addition to that, we have these M replicas that are coming from the log replica trick. So this is an N by M replica. So this is how the two replica tricks play together. To do this calculation correctly of the von Neumann entropy, we really need to introduce an M additional replicas. Now, of course, just if we're just interested in log Z, we don't need all of this large amount of replicas. We just need M replicas, which again are not coupled in any way. And since we're working with ADS boundary conditions, so we don't care about the flat region, then I'm going to draw these as disks because it's ADS asymptotics. So we just have M of these. So now we're back to the log Z replica trick. This was just an aside to remind you of what the, to explain the relation to the earlier replica trick we saw with the von Neumann entropy. Now, what we'd like to see is if there's a simple theory of gravity and we can do a calculation where there's a regime where replica wormholes actually contribute to log Z as much, at least as much, as the disconnected topology. So we can see the replica wormholes at play in this different replica trick for a different observable. Now in JT gravity, and also in some other cases, there have been quite a few studies of lack of factorization due to contributions of connected topologies to this path integral on M boundaries. So obviously, if this object receives contribution from connective topologies, then so does this object, which is the same thing, just multiply by 1 over M and subtract 1. So it seems trivial to say, okay, well, clearly you must include the connected topologies here. But what's really subtle here is that M goes to 0 analytic continuation. And as it turns out, something really interesting happens when you go to the, when you take this M goes to 0 analytic continuation. So let me now talk about free energy in JT gravity. So since I'm running a little bit low on time, I prepared this slide, I thought this might happen. This slide is just going to give an overview of what our results are, and then I'll see how much I managed to get through as far as the technical details go. So what do we find? Again, this is work with Sebastian Fischetti and Alex Maloney. We do find that replica wormholes give a larger contribution to log Z than disconnected topologies at low temperatures. So there's the temperature range where this is the case. In fact, if you want to tell us, no, you're wrong, you shouldn't include these topologies, if you just do the calculation with the disconnected topologies, which is essentially just the annealed free energy, you get a pathological free energy, something which is very unphysical. And it's clear that you cannot get away with this. You cannot just compute disconnected topologies. Now, the pathological behavior appears to be a little bit mitigated if you include replica wormholes, but actually it's not sufficient. If you just include replica wormholes, you do a naive calculation including the replica wormholes, you find you still get this pathological behavior, even if it looks not quite as bad. And what the pathological behavior is that the free energy is non-monotonic with temperature, which means that you have a negative entropy somewhere. So even with the inclusion of replica wormholes and a resummation of genus expansion, the free energy is non-monotonic with temperature. So what goes wrong? We don't include replica wormholes, we get a bad answer. We include replica wormholes, we also get a bad answer. What's going on? The only thing that can go wrong is the analytic continuation itself, M goes to zero. And there's actually a lot of freedom on how to do this. There's a lot of freedom in the choice of analytic continuation. And the obvious or simple analytic continuations actually turn out to be wrong. Now, I want to make a comment here, which is this is actually highly reminiscent of replica symmetry breaking in condensed matter systems and spin glass systems, which they're this very similar story. So you can try to compute the annealed free energy, basically just including uncorrelated replicas in these spin glasses, and you get a very pathological free energy. And you find that if you include the correlated replicas, which are the analogs of our replica wormholes, this improves, but does not fix these problems. And the way that they fix the problems is by taking a different type of analytic continuation, something called Parisi ansatz. And that is a multi-step replica symmetry breaking of the symmetry between the replicas, the permutation symmetry. Now, if we really want to take this parallel seriously, or maybe not so seriously, but we're looking for inspiration, this might suggest that the correct analytic continuation in our case requires some version of replica symmetry breaking. So these are the big ideas. And in the last few minutes that I have left, I'm going to just go over some of the technical details. Actually, how long do I have right now? You're muted.
I mean, basically you're over time, but you can have 2 more minutes.
I have 2 more minutes. Okay. I'll be
1 minus 2 minutes.
Okay. All right. So in that case, maybe let me make a few comments and then I will close. So I don't have time to go through it, as it turns out, any of the calculations in technical detail today. So I will not have a chance to talk about this. Please do ask questions, or if you want to see the technical details of the calculations, please ask on Slack or email. I don't have time to go through the fascinating parallels with spin glasses, so I'll skip over those. But the big takeaway is that in at least some low-dimensional theories of gravity, there exists at least one regime in which replica wormholes must make a large contribution to log z to avoid various pathologies. And this contribution requires a highly non-trivial analytic continuation that seems to be very analogous to what happens in spin glasses where you get replica symmetry breaking. So let me go to my final slides. And so anyone who's interested, please ask questions about the technical details of this. So these recent developments on black hole information front, they've suggested that Euclidean wormholes should be included in the gravitational path integral. Now, there are multiple ways of interpreting this, as I said. One is computing on ensemble average. We'd like to understand how general the statement is about the inclusion of Euclidean wormholes. How does it work in higher dimensions, for example? Should we include them in higher dimensions? We also would like to know how to calculate everything the gravitational path integral computes without using the gravitational path integral black box. All of this means we have to understand the gravitational path integral better. And so I'm going to, since I'm really running short on time, yes, I will leave this here. And thank you very much for your attention.
So thank you for a nice talk. And we'll have some questions and answers. So we have a question in the chat already from let's see. There was a question on the Slack. So maybe who is presenting the questions on the Slack? I'm not sure. And Tony Speranza on Slack.
Yeah, sure. I could just ask it. I was just wondering, you said there's an interpretation of replica wormholes that's not an ensemble average.
Yeah.
Do you have an idea? Can you briefly say what that is? I wasn't aware.
So I think you can imagine that you have some kind of a cancellation if you have this off diagonal terms, and when you there's some kind of a cancellation that might cancel out exactly. I think there's been some work on this. I remember there's some discussion of this in the West Coast paper, I think. So it's not necessarily, it doesn't have to be an ensemble average. It's some kind of a self-averaging quantity that maybe goes away in some approximation, but is enough to sort of cancel out to take care of the factorization issues.
But is the cancellation like related to this degeneracy that, is it something related to what Maroff and Maxfield talk about with their degeneracy, or is it something different?
You mean these alpha states, null states, I think maybe.
Yeah.
Is Henry in the audience? Maybe not.
Yeah.
Maybe not. Yeah. Oh, I'm here.
Okay.
Sorry. I'm not sure I have anything sensible to say there right now.
Okay. No, I was just asking if you had a specific thing in mind for what that non-ensemble average was.
It was really, I guess I'm fairly agnostic about what ends up taking care of the replica wormholes so far. I think they've been, in higher dimensions, it seems to me that I'm a little concerned about the interpretation of ensemble average from the perspective of something like n equals 4 super Young males. So one of the reasons I don't want to promise that that's what's happening here.
Okay, thanks.
Can I continue? I think I think I have maybe two related, it's the same kind of questions of Anthony, is that, so I understand you don't want to go towards the ensemble average, but let's stay a little bit before, because I thought the argument was that if you have Z of B square, which is not the average of Z B square, you know, you need something to, that averages over it. If it is an ensemble average, that is, if it's really a statistical ensemble of something, the fact that that something is unitary doesn't change the fact that it's not a unitary description. I think it doesn't matter what are the individual elements of a statistical ensemble. It is a statistical ensemble. I think we could agree on that.
Yes.
That an ensemble average is non-unitary. Now, maybe that average, I think what you're saying is that it could be that this average is an average in a unitary theory. That's what you're saying, which is that's the only possibility, because you still need to have Z, the average of ZB square, which is not the same thing as the average of ZB to the square, right?
Yes, and I mean, I don't want to subscribe to any one particular interpretation. I think some people might say that if you, as long as each individual member of the ensemble is evolving unitarily, then you're fine, or you might want the entire ensemble to evolve unitarily. Okay. Well,
I thought that the way the calculation appeared was that it was an ensemble, let's say in the matrix model, but you're saying there's other derivation where it's not that clean or clear.
Well, let me be clear. So when you talk about a particular calculation, do you mean these replica wormhole derivations?
Look, you're the expert. You have to tell me which one I should look as the main dominant, you know, resolution of the paradox.
You can talk, if you're doing, for example, SYK with the idea of looking at something like JT gravity, then you can average over the coupling, for example. But I don't think that it's clear to anyone what is happening in higher dimensions as far as this averaging goes.
No, I agree. But in 2D, I thought the main claim was that there was a clean resolution with a particular model. And there was a clean understanding of what the resolution is. But are you saying that it's not that clear?
I don't think
so. In 2D.
I would not say that I feel like I know what the resolution is.
Okay.
We have two more questions, one by Alicia, and then Daniel.
So my question is, if this Euclidean path integral, from the point of view of Euclidean path integrals, you said that you can interpret this as an ensemble average. But what is the point of view, or what would be the interpretation from the Lorentzian path integral point of view?
Very good. You're saying everything I did here was from the Euclidean path integral. What about time evolution?
Yep.
I think the answer to that is I don't know. You could imagine, the safest thing to say is I don't know. I mean, I think that there are ways to imagine extending some of these calculations. I think people have thought about this. I would say I don't know how you would exactly go about doing a Lorentzian. Well, these are Euclidean wormholes, what the analog is in the Lorentzian picture.
But there are already some interpretations of different things in the Lorentzian case, right? So there are yet no insights about this ensemble average.
So I'm not familiar with any, but I'm missing some piece of the literature. If anybody in the audience is aware of something, please pipe up and say something.
Okay.
Daniel?
Yeah, I just wanted to address a bit more of the comments of Tony and Laurent. It's true that there are these weird low-dimensional theories where the gravitational path integral makes sense. And it's also true that in some cases, it's been shown that the Euclidean path integral summing over topologies for those models is exactly equal to an ensemble average. In higher dimensions, that is not true. And I think when Netta said that there might be other ways in which it could work, there's not, I mean, there's no concrete example of that, but the scenario, there's a clear scenario for how it should work, which is that these Euclidean path integral calculations, there are some observables that they reliably compute and some observables that they don't reliably compute. And in particular, the kind of observable that they don't reliably compute are like individual matrix elements of the quantum state is one example. Another example is this so-called spectral form factor, which is the, you take the partition function and insert it e to the minus iht and then evolve for a long time. The idea is that even in a fixed theory like in n equals 4, these replica wormholes still should contribute. It's just that in the observables which aren't reliably computed by the path integral, there are other non-perturbative contributions which are just as big. So in particular, when you're trying to decide whether the partition function factorizes or not, the idea would be that even though you do include the wormholes, nonetheless, the partition function factorizes. And the reason is because there are other contributions coming from non-perturbative quantum gravity, which you can't reliably compute using the path integral. And then the obvious complaint then is, okay, well, why don't those things contribute to the von Neumann entropy or the Rényi entropy? No one has a completely rigorous answer to that, but the idea is that the von Neumann entropy is more robust than this question of the factorization of the spectral form factor. And somehow these mysterious non-perturbative quantum gravity contributions that are not captured by the path integral average out in the calculation of the von Neumann entropy, leaving the replica wormhole contribution just sitting there, you know, even though there were other terms that before you did the full computation somehow were naively bigger. So that's a scenario. That's the scenario that's advocated in the West Coast paper in section 7, and I think probably is the correct scenario for how things work, like in a fixed unitary theory where there isn't actually any average.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, we have to round off soon, but there was one more question by Steve Giddings.
Yeah, so this is maybe amplifying a little bit on what Laurent was saying. It seems to me that in this story, there's a key question, which is, if you go to a member of the ensemble, we would like to think that there is unitary evolution for that member. And then the question is how to understand that at the level of amplitudes. And, you know, presumably that involves some big correction, significant correction to Hawking's original story, et cetera. And, you know, that really is a question which we haven't yet had a really good answer to. And I think that's an important one which we should think about. What is it that unitarizes evolution for a single member of the ensemble?
Yeah, I agree 100%. I think it's one of the most important questions that we need to be looking into right now. I completely agree.
Okay, so let's round off here. There's a discussion session on this REMO coming up now. So it can continue there. And also there's a Slack channel for more private discussions. So let's thank the speaker again.